There's a widespread belief that in the late Middle Ages, the English lordship in Ireland was in crisis. This is misleading. It is true that the colony was not what it had been before the Black Death, when English lords had controlled three quarters of the island. But in fact, the lordship had reached its low point in the mid-15th century, when England was torn apart by the Wars of the Roses. Since then, it had actually expanded, as frontier lords like the Kildares regained territory lost to adjoining Irish families. The decision in 1495 to enclose the counties of Dublin, Kildare, Meath and Louth by a defensive ditch called the Pale looks at first sight like an admission that things were desperate. The Pale, however, was only the inner core of the lordship, the area where the king's courts sat regularly and the chief governor and council in Dublin enjoyed direct control. Beyond this lay the estates of English magnates such as the Butlers of Tipperary and Kilkenny and the Earls of Desmond in Limerick and Kerry. Over time, these descendants of medieval conquerors had, to differing degrees, adopted the language, dress and customs of their Gaelic neighbours. But this pragmatic adaptation to their political and cultural environment was compatible with continuing awareness of their English ancestry and their allegiance to an English monarch. Indeed, the main political problem of the late 15th century was not a rejection of English overlordship, but rather that Ireland's most powerful magnate, the Earl of Kildare, had backed the losing side in the English Civil Wars. After several tense standoffs, however, an accommodation was reached. Henry VII accepted that Kildare was the local magnate best fitted to keep Ireland in order. Kildare, contrary to later myth, accepted that he ruled in the name of the king. The English colony in Ireland, then, was in better condition than is often assumed. In a changing Europe, however, it was nevertheless an anomaly. This was the era of centralisation and state-building. In England, Henry VII, having seized the throne in 1485, had tamed the aristocracy, forcing them to disband their private armies and submit to royal justice. By the 1530s, his son Henry VIII was seeking to tighten his grip on his outlying dominions. The overthrow of the Kildares in Ireland coincided with similar action against local magnates in Wales and on the Scottish borders. However, this is not to suggest that either the king or his advisers had a clear-cut strategy for the conquest of Ireland. On the contrary, accident and miscalculation played a central role in shaping the outcome. The first step was in 1520, when Henry removed Kildare and sent the Earl of Surrey with instructions not just to impose direct English control on the lordship, but to induce the Gaelic-Irish lords to submit to the crown. It was a naive strategy, based on the assumption that all that was necessary was to present the Irish with the self-evident superiority of English institutions and culture. Within 2 years, Surrey had been recalled, and 2 years later, Kildare was once again Lord Deputy. But the damage had been done. The Kildares had achieved power under Henry VII by unleashing sufficient mayhem to demonstrate that only they could deliver a stable Ireland. Now, under threat, they resorted to the same tactics. Kildare was removed from office, restored, then removed again. In the end, with the 9th Earl in prison in London, it was left to his less experienced son to launch an armed protest that escalated into full-scale insurrection, forcing Henry VIII to drastic action, a military expedition, and the capture and eventual execution of young Kildare and other senior members of his family. The crushing of the Kildares solved a short-term problem. No other Irish magnate was able to provide reliable control of affairs in Ireland. Instead, a succession of English chief governors struggled to cope. Sir Anthony St. Ledger in the 1540s developed a bold programme designed to convert Irish warlords into English-style nobles. A similar strategy of assimilating native lords into the ruling class of an expanded English state had worked in Wales in the late Middle Ages and was to work in the Scottish Highlands after 1603. In Ireland, however, circumstances did not leave time for a change of behaviour and mentality on the scale required. The power vacuum left by the removal of the Kildares required an immediate response, particularly since Henry VIII's break with the papacy had given Ireland a new significance as a potential base for attack by the Catholic powers of Europe. Hence, a succession of chief governors found themselves engaged in escalating military campaigns. In the Midlands, which the Kildares had previously kept quiet through a system of alliances with Gaelic chiefs, an attempt to shore up the western defences of the Pale with two new forts provoked a cycle of uprisings and brutal repression. Another settlement at Newry was meant to create a barrier between Gaelic Ulster and the Northern Pale. Earlier, however, the Crown had recognised the Ulster Lord Con O'Neill as Earl of Tyrone. This meant that after Con died, they were drawn into the civil war that erupted when Con's heir under English law was challenged by the ferocious Shane O'Neill. Alongside these conflicts, along what was becoming a moving frontier, the government had to deal with the feudal lords of English descent. Magnates like the Earl of Desmond controlled their estates without outside interference and maintained their own military forces. The task was to persuade them to abandon private warfare and to accept the jurisdiction of royal judges and officials. In some cases, the attempt was successful. The Burkes of Clanricarde, who had gone further than most other leading families in losing touch with their English origins, had, by the end of the 16th century, become firm supporters of the crown. But the problem, once again, was shortage of time and resources. Local lords could be expected to submit to royal authority only if the state could provide the reliable and effective power that would make their private armies obsolete. But this the crown was neither willing nor able to finance. Instead, it treated magnates like the Earls of Desmond with an inconsistent blend of indulgence and arbitrary severity, provoking a succession of regional revolts. The middle decades of the 16th century were thus years of recurrent warfare. There were campaigns in Ulster against Shane O'Neill, clashes in the Midlands with the O'Moores and O'Connors, and major revolts by the Butlers in 1569, by Desmond in 1569-73, and in Connacht during 1570-77. The fighting was often bloody, but it frequently ended with the Crown accepting the surrender of those involved and restoring them to their estates on promises of future good behaviour. The aim was still to establish government on the English model, where the aristocracy and gentry governed their localities in the name of the Crown. Hence, even Shane O'Neill was received as a guest at Queen Elizabeth's court, while in 1554, the last surviving son of the 9th Earl of Kildare was brought back home to resume his family's role in policing the Midlands. By the late 16th century, however, a new idea was taking shape, that the real solution to the problem of Ireland was not to civilise the local lords, but to sweep them away. Hence, a second Desmond revolt in 1579-83 was followed by the establishment of an English colony on the confiscated lands of defeated rebels. This shift towards a harsher policy is not surprising. Henry VIII's initial intervention in the 1520s and St. Leger's policy in the 1540s had reflected an optimistic vision of rapid progress. The subsequent decades of grinding, unproductive warfare have produced instead a cynicism about the possibility of real progress in changing Irish attitudes or behaviour. The refusal of both the native Irish and the English of Ireland to accept the Reformation, meanwhile, had created a further barrier between the Crown and its Irish subjects. It also gave disturbances in Ireland a more threatening aspect. The leaders of revolts in Munster and Connacht in the 1560s and 1570s had articulated religious as well as political grievances. An expedition to Ireland in 1579 had been part-financed by the Pope. The beginning in 1585 of a prolonged war with Spain and the appearance 3 years later of the Grand Armada further highlighted Ireland's significance as a weak spot in England's defences. It was against this background that the Tudor state faced its last and greatest crisis in Ireland, the revolt of the Ulster Lords led by Hugh O'Neill. But even at this stage, it would be wrong to suggest that there was no continuity with earlier periods. As the conflict developed, O'Neill adopted a new political rhetoric, appealing for support from all parts of the island for a crusade for faith and fatherland. He also sought Spanish support to establish an Ireland independent of English control. However, he had begun his career as an ally of the Crown, and it is by no means clear whether he would have chosen his later dangerous course if he had not concluded that there was no possibility of securing the sort of regional autonomy under an English monarch that he had initially sought to achieve. More revealing still is the aftermath of his revolt. For the Ulster Plantation did not, as is sometimes assumed, follow directly on O'Neill's surrender in 1603. Instead, he was restored to his title as Earl of Tyrone and to almost all of his estates, and was even entrusted with powers of martial law to allow him to restore order quickly and decisively to his war-torn territories. Even at this point, the assumption was that Ireland should be governed on the English model by delegating authority to local magnates and landowners and counting on them to maintain order and execute royal decrees. It was not until 4 years later, when O'Neill and other Ulster lords unexpectedly fled the country, that a new king and his advisers opted for the radical alternative of mass settlement of Scots and English on the lands of an imported ruling class. What we see then is that the Tudor conquest of Ireland came about partly by accident and partly by design and a change in ideology. In the 1980s, historians were particularly keen to discover the reasons for what they saw as a major shift in attitude taking place across time. Nicholas Canny believed it came about because English attitudes to the Irish were influenced by news from the New World, where contact with American Indians led people to think more clearly in terms of native people on a lower level of cultural development. Brendan Bradshaw believed that the key influence was Protestant Calvinism, encouraging people to divide the human race into the saved and the non-elect. More recent work, particularly by Ciarán Brady and by Raymond Gillespie, has played down the role of ideology. Instead, they suggest Tudor dreams of a reformed Ireland and the shift to a more harsh, repressive policy came about primarily through exhaustion and the loss of an initial naive optimism about what could be achieved.